book that's just the formula for a quarter weight stub in this particular situation. We'd be looking at a formula called ZO, which would mean the impedance on the line. Z is a little sub O. I said I would always throw peak over the line. I got to tell you about the peak thing simple, Dick. I'm reminding that next. Z with a little O on the bottom, that means the impedance of the line, is equal to the square root of Z1 and Z2. In this case, we can sign these as Z1 50 ohm coax, and Z2 is 75 ohm coax. So basically, if we solve this formula, we would get the square root of 3,750, or it would equal to about 61.2 ohms. I mean, that's if we just went by formula. But I figured I'll take it one step further. We'll do a plot on the fifth chart to show you how we can determine a line. Anybody have any questions up to now or before I start with the fifth chart?
And one quick comment I'm going to make there. Assuming the line is 75 ohms and you're connecting it to a 50 ohm system, in this particular case, because you've got pure resistors, you divide the 75 by 50, and you end up with 1.5. 1.5 is the standing wave ratio. Once you know the standing wave ratio, you can subtract one from that on the top, add one to it, and put the same number on the bottom, divide out, you end up with a reflection coefficient of 0.2. That means of the voltage you're sending down the line, you send down 1 volt down the line, 2/10 of a volt comes back. And if you like doing things in dB, that's a reflection coefficient of a little shy of 14 decibels reflection coefficient, which is darn good. But Mel's going to teach you how to make it better. You got it, Mel.
Okay, yeah, I was going to more or less, they wanted a simple answer, so I get a number of these comments on the email, basically. Mel, we appreciate you when you do it as simple as possible, the least amount of math as possible, the simplest math. So that's what I always try to, you know, make it so that people don't start to go to sleep or turn it off. In this case here, we're going to use this fifth chart. In fact, I think it may be easy to visualize it even easier with this fifth chart, what actually is taking place. In this case, as Dick said, we're using 50 ohms and 75 ohms. Now, if we take this fifth chart, if we take 50 and divide it by 75, we'll get 0.66. So we take that 0.66 and we were to plot it on the Smith chart. Okay? If you look on the Smith chart, look at about the center of the Smith chart where it says 1.0, go to the left and find approximately between 0.6 and 0.7. You'll find approximately 0.66. If anybody has any problem finding it, I'll say it again. Any problem with that so far? Okay, very good. Now, taking our compass, put the pin of the compass on 1.0 of the Smith chart. Take pencil of the compass, open the compass up, put the pencil on that point 0.66. We can call that point A where we started, and rotate the compass in a clockwise fashion until it comes back to that circle. You notice that circle, 1.0 circle, goes around. When it comes back to that circle, stop. Stop at that point and mark that point C, the void, if you'd like, so we can have that as a reference. Any problem with this so far? Okay, next thing we're going to do, we're going to take our straight edge, and we're going to put the straight edge on that 1.0 at one spot. We're going to line it with that point that we just made, point D, where we just had the compass rotated around to the 1.0 circle. And we're going to draw a straight line from that 1.0 through that point right out to the edge of the Smith chart, right? Completely right out to the edge of the Smith chart. Anybody have any problem with this so far? Okay, now, from this, we can do read two points now. If we read the point C on the Smith chart, well, we see it's 1, definitely, minus, because it's below the line, so we know it's going to be capacitive, J, and we're going to see 0.4. So we got 1 minus J, 0.4 as the position of B. Does anybody have any trouble reading that?
Yeah, let me go slow here now, Mel. When you started off at the 0.67 point, you called it 0.66 and it's a little bit closer to 0.67. You called that point A, and then you set your compass, the needle on the center of the chart at 1.0, and the pencil was on point A, and you swung the compass. Did you turn it clockwise, or did you turn it counterclockwise in order to find the 1.0 point? And when you turned it clockwise, did you turn it more than 270 degrees, or did you turn counterclockwise and up less than 90 degrees? Which direction did you go, Mel? You didn't make that clear.
Sorry, I thought I said. All right. With the compass pin on 1.0, the pencil on the 0.66 or 0.67 point, we turned the compass clockwise going around until the circle touches that we're going with the compass until it presses the 1.0 circle again. That will be below the line, below the center line. Is that clear enough? Over.
Okay. There's a slight ambiguity here, Mel, because as you swing clockwise, you're going to hit the 1.0 circle twice, once on the upper half of the Smith chart and when you rotate roughly 90 degrees. I'm doing a very rough approximation, and once again when you rotate 270 degrees. So I think you chose the 270 degree location the second time you hit the 1.0 resistive circle. Is that true? Go ahead.
I did that because I did both of them mathematically and defined there, as I was going to say, defined the truth of which one is actually apropos for this particular situation. And so I didn't want to get into mathematically why you go through this and go to the lower part, the point where you strike, you would say, across the 1.0 again, Dick, because I'm trying to stay away from the mathematics here, but you understand what I'm saying, over?
I sure do. So from your previous experience with Smith chart, you know that in this particular situation, you get a better solution by rotating roughly 270 degrees clockwise until you hit the 1.0 resistive circle the second time. And when you do that, you're in the lower half of the Smith chart where the reactance is now negative or capacitive. Okay, so we're just going to have to take your word for it, but that's the better position. The first one is not as good as what you're saying. You got it, Mel.
Roger, because if you go around and do all the mathematics, you're going to reject that. So there's a way that you can simplify this and determine initially which one you're looking for, but it's a little bit on the complicated side. I'm not going to go get into the complicated mathematics of it because a lot of people told me that's what turns them off. They said they start to read this mathematics and they wind up getting so confused that they just put it aside. So whatever Smith charts you've done up to this point, I've kept the math to the simplest. And in this case here, I'm just giving you a picture of what happens in this line. So with it at this point here, we read this point, we're going to have at B, we're going to have 1 minus J 0.4. And we also drew a line, a straight line, from 1.0, middle of the chart, straight through this point B, right out to the edge of the chart. Is there any problem with this so far that you think of this over?
Nope. And I think you're going to now tell us how many degrees was the perimeter of the chart on the A point, how many degrees was on the perimeter of the chart on the B point, and those number of degrees tell you something about how far back you're going to mount this stub, I'm guessing. So go ahead.
Okay, Roger. Well, basically this will determine the stub length. This is what they were trying to ask in the question. What will be the approximate length of the stub? Where do you start? In other words, like you said, if you trim it down, you know, you get the approximate size, the length of the stub, and then you can always, you know, prune it and everything like that, and for the purist, get the SWR way down. If you read, like I say, point B, we'll have 1 minus J 0.4. And this tells you something. The 1 that we read at this point is purely the resistive. It's a resistive reading. And if the J, the minus J 0.4, that we're actually, this is what we're actually looking to tune out. We know it's capacitive. And this is what we've got to correct for. Does everybody understand that?
Yeah, but there's one other point here, Mel. In order for the stub tuner to work correctly, the stub tuner itself, the stub, if it's a short circuit stub or an open circuit stub, there's two different solutions. The stub has to be the right electrical length of the stub, and the stub has to be in the right location along the transmission line. Along the 70-ohm, let me think now. Are we doing this on the 70-ohm line? Or are we doing it on the 50-ohm line? We've got to make that clear. But we're mounting the stub in a location along the transmission line. So there's two things you got to get right. The location of the D-connector that puts into the stub, if you're doing it in parallel, and the length of the stub. And I think the angle you've measured, that almost 270-degree sweeping of the Smith chart, when you read those degrees on the perimeter, I think that's telling you how far downrange from the antenna you're putting that stub. And make it super clear for me, Mel. Are we putting the stub in the 70-ohm line or in a piece of 50-ohm line? Back to you.
Putting in a piece of 50-ohm line, Dick. And yeah, I just about to get to that. If we read the outer portion of the fifth chart now, this line we drew right straight through, we'll see it read wavelength, and we read 0.359 wavelength. Does everybody see that?
Is that the A point, the B point, or the difference between the two? You might want to make that clear, Mel.
Now, that's the straight line. We drew a straight line from 1.0 through point B and right out to the edge of the chart. We are reading the edge of the chart, so wavelength towards generator. See that, Dick? Over.
Yes, I do. And now it's clear. And you're probably also going to compare it of wavelength toward the generator for the straight line out the A point. And if the delta between those two is the length of line back from the junction, so to speak. Go ahead.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, the next thing we really want to do is we go ahead now and we're going to determine, well, we decided that we would make the stub for the center of the band around 146 megahertz. So first thing we did in this case, or should do in this case, is determine exactly what is 146 megahertz. And we divide 299.7925 by 146 megahertz. We'll see that it comes out to 2.0534 meters. Everybody follow that, over.
So I think you're calculating now what is the free space wavelength for that particular frequency before you add velocity factor of the cable. So I think you're calculating. Go ahead.
Gotcha. That's right. So now, if we are right now, we just determined that the point of 0.359 wavelength, if we take 0.359 wavelength times 2.053, we'll be working in meters up to this point. I can convert it over later on, but we're going to come out with 0.737 meters. That's our cable length. Does everybody follow that?
By cable length, you mean length of cable back from the junction of the two cables. And I think you're doing this correction on the transmitter side. Is that true, Mel?
Roger, on the transmitter side. So we come out to that. And if you want to translate 0.737 meters, it would come out to approximately around 24 inches. Multiply it by 25.4, and you'll see that it comes out to approximately, I believe, 1 inch is closest to us. Well, 1 inch is closest we can calibrate, really, within reason. I guess it's about 25.4 millimeters. Am I correct, Dick?
It turns out that that is an international standard. That's an exact definition. 25.4 millimeters is exactly one international inch. Or 2.54 centimeters, same thing, is exactly 1 inch before you add velocity factor. So I think I see where you're going here. Your transmitter is made for 50 ohms. Coming out of the transmitter is a flexible piece of 50 ohm cable, like RG8. That goes through the hole in the wall that goes outside the house where the hard line is. And somewhere along that flexible cable, which maybe you're not bringing into the house because it's stiff, a little bit more difficult, somewhere along that flexible piece of RG8, back from the connector that goes between the 50-ohm RG8 and the 75-ohm hard line, that junction of those two cables, the distance in wavelength you just calculated back from that point in the 50-ohm line is where I think you're about to add a key connector and you're about to create a stub. Am I on frequency there, Rep. Bell?
Exactly. That's it. We know it's 0.359 wavelength. Now, to get the stub, we know we're going to use a quarter wavelength stub, so approximately we're going to look for something around 20 inches or so to start with. Make it a little longer. If we do the math, we see if we come out with a little shorter. But if we start it with around 20 inches, why I say a little more longer? Because depending on the dielectric of the cable that is used, it will affect the length of the stub. So with a our handheld or whatever instrument, grid the beat or whatever we have, on that frequency of 146, we now can install this piece of cable and trim it, really, until we get exactly our desired effect. Now, if you trim it a little, now you can use an open stub, and you trim it, and you go a little too short, what you can do is you actually can put a variable capacitor on the end of it and touch it up. So it's going to come out to, I looked up a number of dielectrics, different cables with the dielectric, you know, what their capacitance per foot is and things of that sort. And I found that with the average cable, you're most likely going to come out to somewhere around, around 19 inches to 20 inches, somewhere in that neighborhood. Again, depending on the cable. But at least this gives you a ballpark where to start, Dick. Over.
Okay, now one thing I think we may have jumped over here, Mel, and that is you calculated how many wavelengths back from the junction of two cables we're going to install the stub. You calculated how many wavelengths, how many meters and then inches is a wavelength in free space, and then you calculated how many inches back that is from the junction. Did you use the velocity factor of the RGA cable when you calculated the position back from the junction where we're going to install the key connector? Go ahead.
Not really, because I don't think it's really that much going to be critical, because I think when we installed the key connector with the stub, I did a number of ways mathematically, and it didn't make a heck of a really difference thing. Used average dielectric velocity factor, you know, the standard of figures that you'll see in the list of the cables and all. And I didn't see that as becoming, you know, a main factor once you get the approximate spot. And then by just trimming the stuff, seemed to bring it so close that mathematically, you're never going to achieve what the exact figure. Because what I did, a lot of, like I say, if I wanted to do it really with a lot of mathematics, and I don't want to get into that because we're going to lose everybody what's involved in dealing with the capacitance and everything and all, and how to figure it with into microfarads and, you know, and the whole business with dielectric and everything. It actually, when I did that computing, I came out to the exact length of 0.486 meters, which actually translates a little over 19 inches, 19.08 inches. So what I, that's why I said, if you follow basically what I did, use the average cable that RG8U, such as, you know, standard velocity factor dielectric, such as you'll find in the polyethylene dielectric cables and all, and thought out at that point and then trim it, I think would most likely suffice the situation without getting into lots of mathematics, Dick, over.
Okay. Since the polyethylene RGA cable has a velocity factor of 66%, when we did that first calculation of wavelength back from junction, I think we should have taken 66% of that distance back in order to find the exact right location for the T-connector. Because you're mounting the T-connector fairly close to the junction, the total number of wavelengths are small. I'll admit the error is that huge. But for the purist out there, all distances on the cable, I think, should include the velocity factor, which makes the real distance smaller than you think. And there's one other point I want to make here, and that is a lot of people will misunderstand what the picofarad per foot of cable is. If I have a small length of cable, very small in wavelength, and if my manufacturer tells me that his RG58 cable is 27 picofarad per foot, that that's his number. Common sense would lead you to believe if I use 2 feet of it, I would have 54 picofarad. If I use 3 feet of it, I'd have 3 times 27 picofarad, and so on. Not true. Not true. For a very small number of wavelengths, that does work. But if I was building an open circuited stub, I can tell you that when you approach a stub of a quarter wavelength in the cable with its velocity factor, as you hit quarter wavelength to an open circuit, the input of that stub at the T-connector will be zero ohm. It impedance converts. Open circuit at the far end is a short circuit at the near end. You could say the short circuit at the near end is an infinite number of picofarads. So as you start approaching anything more than, I'm going to pick a number, an eighth of a wavelength, you start getting this interpretation of capacitance that's very different from the picofarad per foot the manufacturer told you. There's a way we have to use the Smith chart to find out what length of stub is going to give us what reactant that we're looking for to cancel the reactant that's left over at point B, the 50 ohm point. So capacitance and picofarad per foot takes on this peculiar definition as you start approaching anything more than, I'm going to pick a number, an eighth of a wavelength of length. But, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, that's why I stayed away from getting involved too much more further with the mathematics of determining, you know, anything further than, this is a ballpark, get you to the ballpark, and then if you just, like I say, get you, you know, you can trim it easily, but you're so close to everything. I tried, you know, different variables in it, like you just mentioned, to change velocity factors and putting the velocity factor in, taking it out and everything, and the amount of mass that you got to add in and all that, I don't think was worth the effort, because it didn't make a heck of a difference, because when you start the trimming, you're going to trim it anyhow, you're still going to find that it won't trim exactly to the exact mathematical answer. This is a problem. A lot of people get a lot of confusion that, oh, but it doesn't come out exactly the way the math says. I'm not even going to bother using this antenna or whatever. You know, the meter will be, it's not going to jump off the scale, believe me. So this is going to put you as a purist, and that'll get you so close, I don't think you have to go any further as far as I'm concerned, Dick, over.
Okay, and this will work. But there's a couple of purists out there who might want to know that if you want to get the calculation on the Smith chart or with your handheld calculator two decimal places of accuracy, it is possible to do that. You're going to have to work at it. Just know that there is a better way, but for the average amateur, 98% of the time, this is going to work. You got it, Mel.
Roger, because like I say, I have a whole page of math here in case that anybody wants to pursue it any further. It's a whole page of math here involving
better use your calculator, right, and all kinds of things that you have to get involved with for the purist. But this, I can say, will get you so close, I don't think you'll be desiring to go any more than this point. You know, we're dealing with something that has a, even if you're plus or minus 5%, in fact, that's what it showed off, really, when I did the math and really worked it down to the nitty-gritty, Dick. I went plus or minus 5%. And that is not going to make a heck of a lot of difference on even a pure SWR over.
Now, there's one more hidden thing you did. You gave us a simple approach. But because you were building a shunting device, not a series device, you really have to do things in the admittance world, not the impedance world. Your point A already was the admittance world, and you didn't mention that to us. When you connect a 50-ohm piece of cable out of the transmitter, and it comes outside the house and suddenly joins a 75-ohm piece of hard line, that is a step up impedance. There, the standing wave ratio is 1.5, and in theory, we should have started off at the 1.5 point to the right part, to the right side of the center of the Smith chart. That would have been, let me call it, 0.8 prime. And then, because you know you're going to be working with shunt admittances and not impedances, you draw a line through the center of the chart from that 8 prime point over to your 8 point, and from then on, the chart is really an admittance chart, not an impedance chart. Minor point, it'll scare people. You skipped over that. It did the right thing. But again, if a guy wants to know what's happening, maybe you should know a couple of those words, that there's a little more going on than first meets the eye. Life ain't simple. K2KEY, K2LIW.
It's very typical of the impedance.
I should have said that. One over impedance, one over Z, is called Y, admittance. And so just by flipping to the opposite side of the chart, by drawing a line from the point where you start through the center to an equal distance on the other side, your chart becomes an admittance chart. And so from there on, Mel did the admittance solution, and he was afraid to tell us that it's going to scare people. I understand. You got it, Mel.
Oh, did I stay away from that? I put myself that longer. Did I say he's going to break? She said, she's shaking her head. She said, I knew. She said, just as you said, that word, we must be contacting each other by mental telepathy. Also, while we're on the air here. Yes, as Dick just said, actually, when you divided the made the division of dividing 50, 75 into 50, and then putting it along the line there, actually what we're doing is the 75-ohm line is entered as conductance. So what we have now, basically what we're trying to do is the 50-ohm transmitting, the 50-ohm line is the transforming section. I just want to get into that, Dick, over.
You got it, and I think it's about as deep as we want to go tonight.
Why, I stayed away, Dick, because I get a lot of emails that are telling me that we get a little too heavy at times on that night. They lose us completely. So, I try to, they beg me, they said, Mel, you always come up with nice, simple answers, and then we understand. For those who want to, you know, delve into the mathematics, there's plenty of books and things on it, but, you know, I think we should, Dick, I don't know if we've discussed it, but I think we should not get into too deep into mathematics here unless somebody really has had a good mathematical background or is an engineer over.
Graduate work. Well, at the undergraduate level, my particular teacher, Dr. Howard Boyer, who I think was still there when Howie went to the same school, Pratt and Computers, he was teaching this in the last month of the senior year of the electrical engineering course. He did put this kind of jazz on the final exam. So he had us doing stub corrections for crazy impedances on coax cables. And this solution, Mel tells you the way to get the solution for the input end of the cable. That matches the 50-ohm transmitter. through a length of RG58 50 ohm cable, and there's eventually going to be a junction where the 50 ohm cable suddenly jumps into the 75 ohm hot line, and the right number of wavelengths back from that junction, you put a T connector in the 50 ohm line, and you put the stub off to one side to correct it. Once you've got that solution on the transmitter end, assuming your antenna and all the other hardware on the top of the tower is also a 50 ohm antenna and 50 ohm low noise preamplifier and so on, if you build the exact same network of 50 ohm cables and a stub tuner and whatever, and you put it at the other end at the top of the tower, don't even have to redesign it, just do it again and mount it backwards. Now the 75 ohm cable jumps into the 50 ohm cable, the same number of wavelengths back from that junction, you've got a stub up there, and once you build the stub down below and you tune it and you're happy with it, into a 75 ohm dummy load. You better use 75 ohm dummy load, not the 75 ohm cable, because the cable itself is doing some funny things because it's got a 50 ohm load at the far end. So you're going to do this test with a 75 ohm dummy load resistor. But once you build that beautiful matching network at the transmitter end, simply build two of them, properly weatherproof one of them, and mount the second one on top of the tower, and now you've got a perfect system on both ends, and the whole system is happy, highest possible performance, and now you can start doing moon bounce if that's what you want to do. Now, Howie's recommended that you don't use a 75 ohm resistor, use the real cable, because you're putting transmitter power into it. Most of us have enough sensitivity in our standing wave ratio detecting equipment that you could run a fraction of a watt and still get a good reading on the meter. I would recommend doing it with a pure 75 ohm resistor, and there's various ways you can get that. If you used your real 50 ohm line and the far ohm, your real 70 ohm hard line as the load for your network that you're building, the disadvantage of that is that the far end of that has to be loaded with something. Well, if you had the perfect impedance matching device for the top of the tower, that problem would go away. The 75 ohm cable would look like 75 ohms. But when you put a 50 ohm antenna on the top of a 75 ohm piece of hardline, you already have a 1.5 standing wave ratio on that cable. Therefore, unless you're an even number of quarter wavelengths of cable away from that antenna, the input impedance of that cable will not be 75 ohms resistive, only at those magic lengths in that particular case. So using the real 75 ohm cable as the load when you're doing the tuning could create some confusion. It would work. And so the average ham who's doing this impedance matching at all probably is only going to build an impedance matching network just for one end, the end in the shack, in which case that's good enough, and yes, that's the right way to do it. Put the antenna on the end of the cable and build the impedance matching network in the shack. But if you're eventually going to build a pair of them because you want the system to be perfect on both ends, then you've got to find some way of making it exactly a 75 ohm load when you're doing the tuning. Now, that's my belief on that one. I wonder if you've got another opinion on that one, Howie. Go ahead.
Question.
Question, we'll pick you up in a second. Now, Howie first.
Well, I would use you are at the shack.
Okay.
I'll talk to you in 1 minute.
Understand. The person with the question, start up with your name and your call letters, and then proceed with your question. My name is Dick.
2 meter. Transmit. Hey, the name is Larry, WB2CQT. I missed the very beginning, but couldn't you use a simple ballon made with a toroid in a little box?
BB2HWW. Can I finish my comment?
Yeah, let me talk to Larry first, and I'll turn it over to you in a second. And that is, without a doubt, you can do it with a toroid in a simple box. And on HF frequencies, that's an appropriate way to go. When you get up to 2 meters and 432 and 1296, I think the answer is no, Larry. At those frequencies, the ferrite starts becoming lossy. The ferrite itself and the winding of it, unless you're very skilled at extremely short lead mounting and whatever, you're going to have some stray inductances and stray capacitances. Yes, without a doubt, you can do it with a toroid. But for the average guy doing it in a mini box with real UHF connectors, the chances of it coming out the way he wants to is not 100%. Step pruning technique is the ideal solution. You do it correctly, you get a perfect solution with the step tuning. And the toroids, I think, would work very well at HF frequencies. At HF frequencies, the length of cable required starts getting a little bit excessive, and it becomes a slightly homely assembly. So, as I see it, when you're doing the tuning procedure, a real 75-ohm resistor has some merit. It's a little bit difficult to establish that. And there's various ways you can make a 75-ohm resistor. A smart guy will put a 50-ohm load in parallel with another 50-ohm load where he knows he's got a 2-to-1. Nope, that won't do it. Sorry about that. 50-ohm load in parallel with probably something like 100 ohms. Nope, that wouldn't do it either. Ah! To make a 75-ohm dummy load, you've got to start off with something like a 75-ohm resistor. In order to tune this into a pure 75-ohm dummy load, you probably own the hardware to do that. How would you go about making a 75-ohm dummy load to do the tuning of this cell? KQKEY, KQRIW.
Okay, this is KQKEY. I have something called a carbon pile. I think it was International Rectifier. I think they made it. Oh, they made a number of these. I think it's not carbon. I think they call it carborundum pile. Am I correct in the name, Dick? Over.
Could be. Now, that carbon pile, carborundum pile, or whatever, probably made as a high-power dummy load and up to 30 megacycles, I would trust that. On 2 meters and 432, I would worry about whether or not it's got some stray inductance. Go ahead.
No, this is a very, you know, what they have, they made them up. It's amazing how the heck they made these things. I'm doing here right now. That's what I'm doing now. Plays around with spoons and forks, and I just put out a dishwasher. this little pile is very compact little pile, and it was meant for a laboratory. You got a thing on top of it that, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a grinder and all. It's not really like a potentiometer thing. It's like a grinder. It was used for calibrating precise resistances, non-inductive precise resistances. So I tried it, and I could take a digital voltmeter. Now, they didn't use, of course, when this was made. They didn't use digital voltmeters. They had analog meters, and I assume they were able to, with number of instrumentation, get fairly close to the resistance value. But I was able to set this doggone thing exactly at different ohmeg. Was unbelievable, Dick, how even on the mechanical situation you're able to achieve precise ohmeric readings with this thing. Over.
Okay, with your digital voltmeter and even with a four-leaded resistor test, the so-called Kelvin connection, I believe that your pile could get you to 75.00 ohms resistively. But if the length of any of the leads or if the length of the pile itself is more than a quarter of an inch, then at 2 meters or at 432, it could have some stray inductance where it's not pure 75 ohms with skin effects at that frequency. I'm saying that the possibility that exists if it's not specifically rated for VHF, UHF application, I know that.
WB2CQT.
You have to CQT one moment. Yeah, you're right, Dick. This is what's not... Actually, I don't think it was specifically for RF work at the time. This thing goes back to World War II. And, they may have... I think some World War II, of course, equipment of ready was on 2 meters. I know the Mark 522 is already a rig that they were using for tank communication between tanks on 2 meters, and I think that radar already operated at 2 meters, so possibility that they have some application for these type of devices. Even, I don't think there was a spec chart on, really what the specifics of this carborundum pile was. But you're right, of course, if you start adding anything in the way of connection to it, any distance, any length, of course, it's going to introduce another factor to it, but, again, we're just going back to being the purest, I'm sure, for amateur radio use of just to terminate with 75 ohm loads, I think a thing like this would be sufficient to take over.
Larry recognized probably would be, but I worry a little bit. See, I recently had a problem where I had to terminate 1,000 watts at 1,200 megacycles, and boy, that's a difficult problem to get a very low inductive 50 ohm resistor at 1,000 watts. Very, very difficult. And the Bird Company, among other companies, makes dummy loads like that. You disassemble one of those and you see what's inside, and you'll say, wow, what a bunch of stuff required to make a 50 ohm load at the 1,000 watt level. It's not one simple lumped resistor. It's a distributed resistor network. One way of looking at it is you could say they made a dummy load by creating a whole lot of series insertion loss attenuators. The first attenuator was half a dB in series with a 1 dB, in series with a 2 dB, in series with a 4 dB, in series with an 8 dB, and so on. And that way the number of watts of dissipation along each attenuator is the same number of watts per inch. And eventually, when you get the power all the way down to a kilowatt, and for enough of those attenuators, you get down to the 10-watt level, and then you can put a 10-watt dummy load at the far end of the fence. But all of that's wrapped into the package. So high-powered dummy loads that are purely resistive at VHF and UHF frequencies, nothing to sneeze at. It's a serious mechanical and electronic engineering problem. Let's see what Larry has to say. W2CQT, K2LAW in the tech man.
Okay, it's WB2. Just for like half a watt, the surplus military signal generator I have laying here that goes up to UHF has various attenuators and terminations at various, there's some for 50 and there's some for 75 and I think there's some others. And they're on BNC connectors and you just hook it on there and make your measurements.
Okay, now these are BNC connectors that you put on the front end of the signal generator, and it converts the 50 ohms out of the signal generator into 75 coming out. So, if I understand correctly, as opposed to it being a dummy load of 75 ohms, there are very few signal generators that contain a dummy load on the front panel. But maybe that's what you're saying, Larry. Back to you, Larry.
It comes with a whole bunch of accessories. Some of them are dummy loads that are on BNC connected, at 50 ohms and 75, and I think some other also. I can't get to it right now to look at it. But you could just, it's on a BNC conductor, it's very small, it'll probably take half a watt.
Out of curiosity, is that a Marconi brand name signal generator?
No, it's military surplus. It's American-made.
Interesting. If I understand correctly, Bell, you did intend to have that impedance matching device on the transmitter end, and once the guy has it properly tuned, he can build an identical one for the receiver end, the antenna end up on top of the tower, with good weatherproofing. That's easy to do. It's not a very elaborate network. It's quite simple, in fact, and it's worth the effort if you're doing state-of-the-art work, like moon bounce or meteor scatter, which you want the last little bit of sensitivity of the system and the least amount of loss of the line. But during the alignment procedure, I think a guy might have to take a 1-watt or a 2-watt resistive 75-ohm resistor, carefully mount it in the right package, use that as a dummy load during the alignment, because if it uses the cable itself, what you terminate the cable with is a little bit difficult. I guess one approach would be hope that somebody gives you a 1,000-foot roll of 1,000-foot roll. Hope that somebody...
2 meter transmit.
Somebody gives you a 1,000-foot roll of 75-ohm cable, and then use that as a dummy load, because by the time the signal goes down 1,000 feet and comes back, the reflective signal will be very weak, and what you terminate the far end with will help, and you can get away with murder in that case. Well, not too many guys are going to get a piece of 75-ohm cable given to them. So that the proper 75 ohm resistor does take a little bit of care to do it right. But then again, that's just for that last little bit of tuning. K2KEY. K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger.
This
is K2KEY. Okay. Basically, like I say, I just wanted to get over how we basically come up with a quarter wave above the situations like that. And you can use that basically to calculate that, you may want to make up one for sometime you may have a situation. The person that did mention, taking the balance box up there. Anything below 28 megahertz is not really practical, really. 28 megahertz, even at that point, configuration rather than starting with a toroidal in a box. It's more practical, I feel, in my as far as I am concerned. I mean, that's my concern, that I'm going to say that as far as I feel about it, I would look into a subtype rather than a toroidal, solve a situation like this. So you can use a SIP chart, and you can make one up if you have to. Same method right now. If you want to do it for 50 or 2 meters, 220 or 432, you can apply basically the same method. All right, I guess we can go on, Dick. You want to take another one over?
Yeah, one other thing I want to mention about the toroidal approach. The toroidal approach is nice at low power level. I'd be rather reluctant to run the toroidal approach at 2 meters at the kilowatt power level. The number of pieces of ferrite on planet Earth that can take 1,000 watts at 2 meters or 1,000 watts at 432, that's a rare requirement, a rare item. I don't think that's a very easy way to go. The pure approach is the subtuner approach. And although it's a little bit bulky in length of cable required, I would still be willing to use the subtuner approach even on 80 meters, knowing that it has no trouble tolerating a couple thousand watts, if that's what I want to put into it in peak and below power. Why don't you go to your next interesting one in the mailbag, Mel?
Hey, this is KEY. Very good. All right. We try to give an insight to basically any of these types of devices without getting into the heavy math that took to determine a lot of these answers. If you want to be precise, but if you want to pursue it any further, let me know. I'll give you references. Let's see. What is this one? What do you know about a full-wave triangle antenna system? Because you've been discussing, I don't understand this word. I guess it must be a dipole. Very unusual spelling of dipole. You were discussing vertical dipoles that were experimenting with now. Would it be an advantage for me to make a full wave triangle antenna by adding just size? Well, let me see. What is the kind of thing? Oh, I guess I think I know what it is. In other words, by using one support, using two slants, then one seat down the bottom, seated down on the bottom. In other words, making a full wave triangle, dividing up, take the full wave and then dividing it up into three parts. A full wave triangle antenna. I've never tried such a thing, Dick. Maybe you know something about it, over.
Yeah, at first you would say, gee, if I make a triangle where the base leg on the ground has a total of a half wave, that means each of the vertical portions will be a quarter wave, and now I've got a full wave triangle. And it would appear as though you found a sexy way of feeding the vertical component by way of the horizontal dipole that's on the ground. That's the good news. And yes, you have found a sexy way of feeding it. Unfortunately, that antenna that you and I just described is purely horizontally polarized. When you view it broadside, it will have a significant vertical component when you view it endwise, not broadside, but it's not a pure vertical dipole. In my opinion, a pure vertical half-wave dipole will give you more performance. Now, if you look up the good book, the Antenna Handbook, or if you just Google the word sleeve dipole, bazooka dipole, vertical dipole, end-fed dipole, if you Google those words, you will find out that there is a way that you can see the dipole that's a half-wavelength long in a purely collinear manner. In other words, the dipole itself is perfectly parallel to the transmission line that's feeding it, not at right angles. It takes a little bit of care to use the right length of the sleeve. The bottom half of the dipole, the bottom quarter wave, is a sleeve. In other words, you've got your coax cable going up that sleeve. You get to the center of what you and I would call the dipole. You have the quarter wave resonator above. You have the quarter wave length sleeve below. And when you adjust the impedance, it's just right. In other words, you have the right diameter of the sleeve and the right point of feeding it. Believe it or not, that is a self-balancing antenna. A pure vertical dipole with no, or essentially no, current flowing down the outside of that transmission line. Even though the lower half of the dipole looks like it's launching a signal on the dipole, on the transmission line, if you get the geometry just right, it is a beautiful antenna. I've been doing some experimenting with it professionally recently, and it works like a charm. It takes a little bit of the best to get the geometry to work out right is to go to one of these Googled articles and copy somebody's design. Other than that, it's going to take a little bit of tuning to get the right diameter of the sleeve to make it come out as a perfect balance. If you get it wrong, the antenna still works. It'll still have 97% efficiency. Just you have a little bit of RF flowing on the outside of the transmission line. And if you're a purist, that may bother you a little bit. So it's got a lot going for it, as I see, because vertical to half-wave dipole is an antenna type that has never been given anywhere near the emphasis it should. When it comes to low-angle DX work, I think you're slowly discovering, as I'm discovering, Mel, it's got a lot of capability. K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. What I think he's looking at, if you took, for instance, one support, and then let's say for, want to make, say, a triangle antenna, if you went ahead and, say, let's say 20 meters, and used, divide it up in length. There are three, an equilateral triangle, and then if you fed it bottom,
and
right there in the middle, right at the, at that feed point, I wonder with the distance that part of the triangle above ground, how effective, how much of an effect would that have on the antenna, Dick, over?
It's going to be an effective antenna. It's going to work. The disadvantage is that when you look at it broadside, it's purely horizontally polarized. When you look at it in view, it has some of the properties of a sloper antenna, except that the vertical component now is only going to be one-third of a wavelength long. If you build it as an equilateral triangle. And a third of a wavelength long is longer than quarter wave, but less than half wave. It's going to work. It only requires one support up in the air. And that one support up in the air doesn't have to be more than about a quarter wavelength off the ground. I'm also worried about the fact that the horizontal portion is going to be launching a lot of RF energy into Earth, unless the horizontal portion is, again, quite elevated. So, although you'll get some great standing wave ratio, and you may like the pattern, I'm worried about its overall efficiency now. You've got a substantial portion of horizontal dipole parallel to the ground, not very many feet off the ground. And therefore, I'm a little worried it's going to launch quite a bit of signal into the earth and warm up the worms in the wintertime as opposed to launching that valuable RF energy into the ether. That mic switch of yours is giving you a little bit of trouble from time to time, Mel. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's my fault, but I'm trying to do things at one time here. Yeah, I get a hold of it. More positive. Yeah, okay, very good. Sounds like a, listen, you know, like you said many times, go ahead and try it. It most likely will work. That's the problem. A lot of people are so hesitant to try an antenna, figuring, like you say, it's not going to blow up or anything like that. You know, enjoy ham radio. Stop worrying about trying to get the mega buck, you know, the kilobuck or whatever powers up there. And without them, you're not going to make contact. You're going to enjoy ham radio with the most modern antennas. That's the bottom line. Must have, gee, you know how many emails I've got that I keep repeating this and all, but they tell me, well, this is the best I can do. I can't put this up. I can have, you know, a hidden antenna or get in a roof and things like that. What do you think? Can I take a chance? Of course you can take a chance. It's the worst that could happen is somebody...